This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty. President Donald Trump has directed that U.S. forces in Syria, numbering some 2,000, leave after declaring the defeat of Islamic State.
We've been fighting for a long time in Syria. I've been president for almost 2 years, and we've really stepped it up. And we have won against ISIS.
The decision expected to be carried out over a period of months. Mr. Trump provided some insight into what may have been behind his decision.
I get very saddened when I have to write letters or call parents or wives or husbands of soldiers who have been killed fighting for our country. It's a great honor. We cherish them, but it's heartbreaking. There's no question about it. It's heartbreaking.
The news stunned lawmakers on Capitol Hill, including outgoing Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Bob Corker, who said U.S. allies appeared not to have been consulted.
To my knowledge, we didn't even communicate with them. It's caught everybody off guard. I know that I doubt there's anybody in the Republican caucus in the Senate that just isn't stunned by this precipitous decision that just like you woke up in the morning and made it. I understand there have been some discussions, but my sense is that it's been a shock throughout the administration that this type of decision was made.
The decision followed by days a warning from Turkey that it was about to launch another military operation targeting U.S.-backed Kurdish fighters of the Syrian Democratic Forces who've been fighting Islamic State across northern Syria. In Democratic Republic of Congo's capital, police fired tear gas to break up opposition supporters after the governor presiding over Kinshasa ordered a halt to campaigning over security concerns. The order came ahead of Sunday's presidential election. A senior election official said the ballot to replace President Joseph Kabila may be postponed after voting machines were destroyed in a suspected arson attack. This is VOA News. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is urging caution following news that China has detained a third Canadian citizen in the wake of the December 1st arrest of Huawei telecom official Meng Wanzhou in Vancouver.
We have engaged in a very, very thoughtful way on trying to get the best outcome. And sometimes politicizing or amplifying the level of public discourse on this may be satisfying in the short term, but would not contribute to the outcome we all want, which is for Canadians to be safe and secure.
The identity of the third Canadian has not been released, but Mr. Trudeau said it appears to be a separate case. Two others, diplomat Michael Kovrig and businessman Michael Spavor, were detained December 10. Meng, Huawei's chief financial officer, was arrested at the request of the U.S. in an investigation into allegations she violated sanctions restrictions. Washington is seeking her extradition. An agreement has been announced between North American Major League Baseball and the Cuban Baseball Federation that allows players from the communist rule island to sign contracts without having to defect. The president of the Cuban Federation, Higinio Velez, said the agreement obtained permission from the U.S. government. It followed more than 2 years of negotiations and runs through October 31, 2021. It seeks to halt the trafficking of baseball players from Cuba by criminal organizations. A state of emergency was declared Wednesday in the Sudanese city of Atbara after hundreds protested against bread price increases and set fire to the local party headquarters of the National Congress Party. Protests occurred in at least three other cities. Meanwhile, Sudan's main opposition leader, Sadiq al-Mahdi, has returned to the country after a year of self-imposed exile. The last democratically elected prime minister told thousands of his supporters it's time for a democratic transition. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari Wednesday unveiled a nearly $29 billion 2019 budget that assumes oil production will remain above 2 million barrels a day and the price will stabilize at about $60 a barrel, while the currency will stay at about 305 naira to the dollar. The economy, which emerged from recession this year, is a top campaign issue ahead of February's national election. U.S. central bank policymakers decided to raise a key interest rate for a fourth time this year. Jerome Powell chairs the Federal Reserve.
After today's action, the target range for the federal funds rate is 2.25% to 2.5%, putting it at the lower end of the range of estimates of the longer-run normal rate provided by the committee.
With the rate of U.S. growth slowing, Powell suggested the pace of rate hikes will slow in the new year. Asian stocks plunged on the news. U.S. stocks were also lower. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. We have two more days to go before Congo's decisive presidential election. The governor of Kinshasa has banned campaigning in the capital.
Why he has to prevent me running my campaign and let other candidates run their own? It's an illegal decision, and my lawyer, they will go to court tomorrow to sue the governor.
Martin Fayulu is the presidential candidate of the coalition of opposition parties in the DRC. Togolese are voting today in a controversial parliamentary election. We'll talk with both the government and the opposition, and East African community lawmakers urge Uganda to continue hosting refugees from the region.
The influx of refugees into Uganda has reached unprecedented levels that require an urgent need for the Council of Ministers to find and adopt permanent and urgent solutions.
Victor Burukukiye is the chairman of the Committee on Regional Affairs and Conflict Resolution. Over 1,000 migrants have died in Africa this year alone, and power generators in Nigeria stand in the way of climate goals. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. With two more days to go before the decisive December 23rd presidential election in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the governor of Kinshasa has banned campaigning in the capital. Campaign was due to end at midnight tomorrow, Friday. Governor Andre Kimbuta, a member of Congo's ruling coalition, says the ban is necessary because he is in possession of information that extremists in the camps of the main candidates were preparing for street confrontation in Kinshasa. But Martin Fayulu, the presidential candidate of a coalition of four opposition parties, says the ban is an illegal ban targeted only towards him. He says his lawyers will go to court today to sue the mayor of Kinshasa.
That decision is not normal because during the campaign, everybody can run his campaign according to what the electoral law said, and no restriction at all. Why he has to prevent me running my campaign and let other candidates run their own? It's an illegal decision, and my lawyer, they will go to court tomorrow to sue the governor.
What do you hope to come out of the lawsuit?
Just to demonstrate that people cannot do what they want, because it's mentioned in our constitution that you are not forced to follow any order which you consider that is irregular.
Mr. Fayulu, you said that why is it that he's targeting you, but Governor Andre Kimbuta says he took the decision to suspend campaigning in Kinshasa because the security forces have information that extremists in all the political camps are preparing street confrontation.
But this is not true. Why they didn't do that in Lubumbashi or someone else? Why, when I went to Lubumbashi, the governor of Lubumbashi took the decision to disturb my campaign? Why, when I went to Kalemi, the governor of Tanganyika did the same? Why the governor of Maniema prevented me to go to Kindu? Why others can go everywhere they want and Fayulu cannot? Why? Why the discrimination?
You and the other opposition candidates have access to the public media, say government television and radio?
They have access on everything they want. They can go everywhere they want. Fayulu cannot go where he wants. When I was in Kalemi, they disturbed my campaign. And I suppose after Kalemi to go to Lualaba, this is Kolwezi. To go to Kolwezi, they told me, no way, I cannot go to Kolwezi. And then I say, okay, I have to go back to Lubumbashi, and then tomorrow I'll proceed to somewhere else. They say, even Lubumbashi, you cannot go. And I ask them why. I got the security guy, the top level security in this country. I got him on the phone. He told me, you have only three airports that you can go in this country. This is Kinshasa, Goma, and Bukavu. Can you imagine? I'm not Congolese. I'm not a candidate. I don't have the same rights as others. I think there is something wrong. Kabila and his people, they are afraid of me. They didn't plan that situation, but the situation is there, and they cannot prevent it anymore. I'm there, and I have to run and I have to win this election, because what the Congolese are saying, it's clear that nobody can compete today.
Martin Fayulu is the presidential candidate of the coalition of four opposition political parties in the DRC. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. Togolese are voting today in a controversial parliamentary election. A coalition of 14 political parties is boycotting today's vote because they say President Fornas Simbe, in power since 2005, has failed to implement key provisions of a roadmap put in place by the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. But Gilbert Bawara, Togo's Minister for Public Administration, says the election will go ahead as planned because the government has taken the necessary steps to make sure that all political parties can participate.
Definitely. I think there's no doubt that the election is taking place, and even the process has already been very active, because one day ago, the military and policemen have already gone to vote. So this question does not have any sense anymore.
Well, Gilbert, as you know, the alliance of 14 opposition parties are boycotting these elections because they say that they are not going to be free and fair because, number one, your government controls the elections commission, and because also your government has failed to meet the benchmark set out by the Economic Community of West African States.
No, I don't think so. You know, the next coming summit of the head of state of the ECOWAS will take place in 2 days, and the head of state will have the opportunity to appreciate and make the evaluation of the implementation of the roadmap on the Togolese and social political situation. So it will be up to the head of state to say if the roadmap has been fulfilled or not. Regarding the Electoral Commission, all the effort has been done to make sure that all the stakeholders can take part in it. And the coalition decided not to participate. There was no way for the government to oblige them to participate. They have the right to participate, but they are not obliged to participate. But there are other political parties and actors who are participating, and the election is taking place in accordance with the roadmap set up by the head of state and government of the ECOWAS. So I don't have any doubt that those head of state will also approve what have been done and implemented until now.
One of the reasons that the opposition believes that these elections are not going to be free and fair, for number one, they claim that your government has failed to release political prisoners that you have in jail, because that was part of the ECOWAS demand. First of all, do you have these political prisoners in jail?
No, we don't have any political prisoners in jail. People have been arrested not because they participated in a demonstration, but because they committed acts that are not allowed by the law. And the roadmap of the ECOWAS did not ask to release them without the trial and the judicial proceedings. The roadmap has requested that the judicial proceedings should be accelerated. This is what we have done. And I'm convinced that the President Faure will also take additional measure of appeasement in the next coming days.
Gilbert Bawara is Togo's Minister for Public Administration. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lomé. The leader of Togo's 14-party opposition coalition says he's disappointed in the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, because the regional group has failed to take a stronger action against the failure of the Togolese government to implement reforms prescribed by ECOWAS. But Jean-Pierre Fabre, leader of Togo's main opposition party, the National Alliance for Change, says the Togolese people will continue to press for constitutional and electoral reforms.
Because the ECOWAS roadmap is not satisfied, and we decided not to be part of this election. And this election are a nonsense, because in the dialogue we are two, and one of the two protagonists in the dialogue didn't participate to these elections. And ECOWAS is not saying anything. This is a very strange attitude from ECOWAS.
Maybe ECOWAS would have liked for you to take part in the election before you can continue to discuss the roadmap.
You know, we know what is good for us. ECOWAS has just stopped a movement which wanted the return of the Constitution of 92. Just what we wanted is the reform, constitutional, institutional, and electoral reforms before going to elections. Now, there are no reforms, and the elections are going on. It's something very strange.
I know the last time I spoke to Brigitte, she said that you had a meeting with the front man for ECOWAS. Are you saying you are not satisfied?
I think we have explained everything to the president, and we are expecting from him and President Alpha Conde to stop the preparation of these elections. That has not been done, and it is a very strange attitude from ECOWAS and from both presidents.
I understand ECOWAS is supposed to be meeting soon. What message do you want to give them?
No message. I'm just very frustrated, disappointed. I have no message. They know what they have done.
I was speaking to someone from the government. He said that the government gave you, the opposition, all the opportunity to participate in this election.
They are liars. We have nothing to say. We will continue the demonstrations, and everybody will understand what is going on. Everybody, ECOWAS, everybody, because we are terrorist people. We know what we are suffering, and we will not accept those kind of things.
Mr. Jean-Pierre Fabre, I appreciate very much, and happy holidays to you.
Thank you very much.
Jean-Pierre Fabre is leader of Togo's main opposition, the National Alliance for Change. You're speaking with me from the capital, Lomé. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton, Washington. Today is Thursday, December 20th. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. The East African Legislative Assembly has called on the Ugandan government to allow refugees from member states who are not willing to return to their home countries to establish themselves in Uganda. This comes after Uganda is considering to get loans in order to meet the needs of the rising refugee population in the country. Moses Javier Rimana reports from Arusha, Tanzania.
Uganda has experienced an increase in the number of refugees from 430,000 in 2015 to 1 million in 2016 and 1.3 million in 2017. According to the UN Refugee Agency, Uganda hosts 1.1 million refugees, with more than 70% of them coming from the East African Community member states. Victor Burikukie is the chairman of the Committee on Regional Affairs and Conflict Resolution in the Regional Assembly.
The influx of refugees into Uganda has reached unprecedented levels that require an urgent need for the Council of Ministers to find and adopt permanent and urgent solutions.
According to the Ugandan government, 68% of the refugees come from South Sudan, fleeing political dispute between President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar, which sparked a war in December 2013. More than 50,000 people have died from the conflict. The East African Community lawmakers called for member states to respect the East African Community Treaty, which calls for member states to maintain peace and security in the region. The assembly notes that insecurity has been the major cause of the refugee influx. Matthias Kasamba is a lawmaker from Uganda.
Our brothers and sisters who are suffering in the camps because of our failure in our internal mechanism to resolve conflicts, to give happiness to the people under our jurisdiction. We are here together, well integrated, talking to each other. But beneath us, the magma is boiling our people. It is very painful. And it should be condemned.
Uganda comes third as a refugee-hosting country worldwide, as the country maintains its open-door policy to refugees. But recently, Uganda said it will review the status of some refugees who have stayed in the country for decades. Oburu Oginga is an MP in the regional parliament.
I hope that the common market protocol, when fully implemented, which gives East Africans a right to go to any country and settle and work, will enable us to settle part of this problem of refugee influx into one member country.
According to the East African Community Common Market Protocol that was signed by all member states more than 7 years ago, East Africans have the right to freely move within the region as well as settle down in any member state should they wish to do so. As the majority of the refugees still feel unsafe to return to their home country, the region is now looking for a harmonized national policy and laws of refugees management in the East African community. Moses Aviarimana, VOA Africa, Arusha, Tanzania.
The Missing Migrants Project says 1,386 migrants died in Africa in 2018, though they caution that this number is probably much lower than the actual number of people who perished trying to cross international borders. Amid signing of the Global Compact for Migration, which happened this week, researchers at the UN-backed Missing Migrants Project say more needs to be done globally to create safe and legal routes for migration. Julia Black is project coordinator.
Our project aims to sort of bear witness to these deaths because, simply put, there is no one else counting these deaths, and accounting drawn attention to this issue to the point of it becoming a major political issue and one that is actually included in the new Global Compact for Migration explicitly, that Objective 8 is to save lives.
What is your take on the new compact for migration that was signed? But also, what do you think needs to happen for people to stop going missing? It obviously needs to be counted. I mean, obviously, your ultimate goal is that this doesn't happen anymore.
Right. So the Global Compact for Migration is a non-legal document. So states are sort of saying that they like the idea of this, but there is no really enforcement mechanism in place at this point. And so one thing that we have consistently advocated for over the years is for states to cooperate internationally to provide safe legal routes for migration. Overwhelmingly, like 99.9% of the deaths that we occur during irregular migration and are due to completely preventable causes of death, you know, such as illness or lack of access to medicine, drowning in a route that they don't need to cross if they could just fly there, and so on. And so what we really try to stress, and what I think is in the Global Compact, is that states should provide more safe legal routes so that migrant deaths decrease.
More than just also providing safe and legal routes for migration, safe and legal routes for traveling to and from these regions, do you think that, is that part of it as well? In addition, calling for safe and legal routes to migrate, but also just safe and legal routes to go back and forth.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think quite a lot of the people who do move irregularly intend to do so only temporarily. We know this is absolutely the case in the United States, where there's quite a lot of seasonal return or circular migration. So absolutely providing more safe legal to not only migration but return home is absolutely crucial.
So this year, in 2018, according to your website, there have been 1,386 deaths of migrants in Africa. This is down slightly from around almost 1,700 the year before. Do you think this is a noticeable difference, a noticeable decrease based on certain actions, or is just a happenstance?
I don't think you can draw anything from our data in terms of trends over time. What we say consistently is that our data represent minimum estimates. Measuring any phenomena related to irregular migration is extremely difficult, and particularly in Africa, there are very strong indications that many, many more deaths occur during migration than we currently record.
That was Julia Black, coordinator for the Missing Migrants Project. She was speaking to Ricky Striake from Berlin, Germany. Generator use in Nigeria is on the rise because of constant power outages. Nigerian businesses spent more than half their budgets on generators every year, according to the country's Rural Electrification Agency. The reliance on generators is believed to contribute significantly to greenhouse gas emissions, a main topic of discussion at this week's climate change conference in Poland. Timothy Obiezu has more from Abuja.
The noise from generators is synonymous with every business area in Nigeria. Ayobami Michael is preparing to get on with his regular workday at his business center in the capital, Abuja, with his daily ritual. He turns on his generator so he's able to power his photocopying and printing machines. But relying on this alternative source of power is expensive.
If you can see that the light has been so bad since yesterday night, it has been so bad for me. I could not do any work seriously like that. I just have to, like, okay, go down to the police station and get petrol.
Most businesses like Michael's here in Nigeria depend on generators so they can operate. Nigerian businesses collectively spend an estimated $14 billion annually on generators, either importing, fueling, or maintaining them. But while generators are costing businesses, generator dealers like Arinze Sebunam say business looks good.
I used to sell the electronics, but I see that more demands are coming on generators. Then I have to stop some television and other things and focus more on generators, because more people, just like today, I sold more than three.
Only 18% of the electricity generated in Nigeria is from renewable sources like solar power and wind. Aside from the noise, they also release harmful gases like carbon monoxide into the atmosphere. Experts accuse the government of neglecting to develop the alternative energy sector, despite the economic repercussions of heavy dependence on generators. Jaye Gaskia is an energy expert and economist.
Every household has a generator. Every small, medium, micro enterprise has a generator. Every big firm, corporation, not only have generators, they actually have power plants, their own power plants. But none of this is integrated into the national grid, so none of this is available publicly, which is what makes, you know, the economic sense not to be really sensible, not to be rational. And the impact that this has is that it's one of the key reasons why the cost of doing business in Nigeria is one of the highest in the world.
Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari is among 20,000 delegates who attended the Climate Change Summit in Poland this month. The goal is for each nation to reduce greenhouse gas to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. But Nigeria is Africa's top oil producer, as well as the biggest importer of fossil fuel-powered generators. Experts say it will not be easy for President Buhari to eliminate the existing generators from over 60 million households. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. With two more days to go before the decisive December 23rd presidential election in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the governor of Kinshasa has banned campaigning in the capital. Campaign was due to end at midnight tomorrow, Friday. Governor Andre Kimbuta, a member of Congo's ruling coalition, says the ban is necessary because he is in possession of information that extremists in the camps of the main candidates were preparing for street confrontation in Kinshasa. But Martin Fayulu, the presidential candidate of a coalition of four opposition parties, says the ban is an illegal one targeted only towards him. He says his lawyer will go to court today to sue the mayor of Kinshasa. And Togolese are voting today in a controversial parliamentary election. A coalition of 14 political parties is boycotting today's vote because they say President Faure Gnassingbé, in power since 2005, has failed to implement key provisions of a roadmap put in place by the Economic Community of West African States. That's it for this Thursday, December 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a good day.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. Heather Maxwell, I know good music, and Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.